Blog Talk Radio.
Happy birthday. Yeah. We want to dedicate this song to everyone who has a birthday today. And that means you, and you, and you, and you. Because having a birthday is a special occasion. And we hope you have a happy celebration and a many, many more to come.
For tuning in to A Book Is Born, Season 10, Episode 1, and it is a privilege and a pleasure to be here. I'm Beverly Black, and that song is Happy Birthday, befitting of the fact that someone is birthing a book all the time. We have stories to tell that are down inside of us. And so A Book Is Born is that platform to bring your words to our audience. We are live on Tribe Family Channel, a Gumbo for the Soul International family brand. This episode is brought to you by Michelle Berard, LLC. That is going to be MICHELEBARARD.com. We are so excited to have her connection on our show. Our guest today is Mr. Edward Rahill. He's going to be telling us about his book, 1 mile at a time. Now, this to me, and I could be wrong, but we will be definitely hearing from the author soon. We're going to get some background on his beginnings and just let him have the microphone. So if you want to listen in, call 515-605-9741, or you can simply listen online at blogtalkradio.com/Gumbo for the Soul. Gumbo for the Soul, Tribe Family Channel, and A Book Is Born are Gumbo for the Soul International family brands created, owned, and operated by yours truly, all rights reserved. Now, here's the backstory. Back in the day around June 4th, 1984, to be specific, six people driving at around 100 miles an hour were arrested on the New York State Thruway in what state troopers described as an organized coast-to-coast race. The six were back on the road after paying fines, but police elsewhere had been warned about the Boston to San Diego race. At least 30 other drivers were believed to be involved in the Michael A. Preston Memorial Four-Ball Rally. Edward Rahill, my guest, was one of them and has written a book about it. Welcome to Tribe Family Channel, Edward Rahill. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. Beverly, it's a pleasure to be here, and God bless you for having me on.
And God bless you as well.
Excited.
Thank you so much. I'm truly excited. You know, I laughed when I started reading this book. This sounds like the Dukes of Hazzard to me. I could post it all online.
The reality of it is, it's true. The things that happened in there were true, and the things that happened to me were life changing events. And I'm just thrilled to have the opportunity to try to share it.
Awesome. Well, before we get into all of the events, give us some backstory on you, where you're from, growing up, and sort of, you know, your character, your likes, your dislikes, the home life, school life, et cetera, before the age of 19 it was when you went on this excursion?
No, I was 30 years old.
Oh, you were 30. I misread.
Yeah,
I was.
No, that's okay. This book is really a. Can I explain? I originally started writing this as a letter to my four children, because I had, after all these events occurred and I had some of these amazing experiences and tremendous career jump, they only knew me when I was a senior officer or CEO of a company. They never knew me as a young boy, never knew about me in how I got to where I was. And I felt
telling us about that young boy. I'm sorry to cut you off, but let me take you back to that young boy and tell our audience, I was going to say family, but same thing, Tribe Family Channel. Tell our family what you told your family as far as your younger days.
Yeah. I grew up in a little town called Gardenville, New York. I came from a broken family early in my age. I was raised by my grandmother. My grandmother was a tremendous, unbelievable influence in my life, and the value systems I developed were directly related to her. If I may just, tell you a little bit about her. She was a young girl in an immigrant Irish family in the south side of Buffalo, who basically only had a fifth grade education. Her first job, one of her jobs was to walk the railroad tracks and pick up coal to sell. And she had a tough life, never really being able to pursue her dreams. And her mother was in a similar situation. At 14 years old, she came from Ireland to the United States and worked as a maid on Delaware Avenue in Buffalo, New York. And so my grandmother basically, had a difficult life. She finally married my grandfather, Ed Cottrell, and she thought everything was the dreams were going to start coming true. And this is important, the sequence here. And she had blessed with four children, all of them under 10, when her husband, at the age of 36, dies from appendicitis.
Oh.
And they had, as a family, he had been working with Ford Motor Company in Detroit, become the first dealer in that rural town of Gardenville, New York. And that there was no money saved. It all went into the business. And so she was in a situation where she really was devastated by the loss of her husband, equally devastated by the fact she didn't have a clue how to provide for her family. And so she would go down to the dealership 7 days a week to learn everything she can and try to make it go. 1 month after this happened, the district manager for Ford Motor came to see her and proceeded to tell her, that they were very condolences for the loss of Ed. We feel awful, but we have to take the dealership away from you. We need to give it to a man. Okay? And remember, this is 1930, so it was a different culture back there. And she basically wrote letters, prayed to do everything. The miracle happened, and I'll get to the word miracle later in our discussion, is the district manager was replaced with a new gentleman out of Detroit who came by to interview her about getting the dealership transferred, and he didn't want to do it. He said to her, I'm going to cover you for a year. I'm sorry, this is emotional for me. I'm going to give you a year. If you can't make it, then we have to take it away. So he put his ass on the line for her, okay? A year and a half later, in my book, there's a telegram from Ford Motor in Detroit congratulating her being the most successful dealer in Western New York. And I think that is a credit to the human being she was. And what happened to me that blessed me in my life was I used to call her mom. I was raised by her. And it very much, she very much in the later years of her life wanted to imprint on me everything she learned. Okay? And the unifying the theme of this book throughout it is the interplay of generations towards human beings and how important it is to try to be connected with the generations that come before you and prepare to connect with the generations after you. And in my book at the end, I talk about life being a relay race. you know, you have members of your team that run before you. You get the baton. Your job is to run as fast as you can. But there comes a time you hand it off to somebody else. And that's the kind of philosophy of life she tried to instill in me. You have a duty to do your best, but you have a duty to pass it on. So that is kind of the concept behind the story behind the book. And it's a philosophy. The reason why I started writing the letter to my children was to start that process to pass on the lessons learned.
Pin that right there to pass on the lessons learned, and then you were starting with the book. But let me tell you something. I am so fascinated. I saw the telegram, and I was like, wow. You know, I'm so glad the way you chronicalized your grandmother's legacy, the fact that, you know, they were actually going to try to, you know, oust her out of business, and the fact that she rose to the occasion with such strong reverence to survive. And it's the reason, like you were saying, the generations before us, they are the reasons why we could be here today. And so I am just so fascinated. I know that you've written One Mile at a Time, but you also let me know. Keep us posted, because I feel as though there is a strong story that can also be brought forth as to the travails that really dial down into the travails of coming from another land and having to try to matriculate in a foreign country. And, you know, like you said, young children, husband passes away, you know, and really knowing that you have to persevere because the generation after you is watching you. You're setting the tone for how they're going to come through and how they're going to address adversity. And so that is, I love the way you laid that out. It is just phenomenal.
Well, thank you.
I'm a grandmother. Thank you. I'm a grandmother's grandchild too. I've sat at my grandmother's feet, and my socialization is shaped by my grandmother's principalities and upbringing. And so when you went there, you had me. You could talk about that all day.
Well, it's true, though. It's true. We will become, we as a people will become better human beings if we continue to follow that path of respecting those before you and learn from them. And then at the end, as you get the later stages of your life, you try to reach out and pass that on to the next generation. That's how we become a better human race, and that's what I believe. And
well, I stand with you on that belief. As we can see in the current state of affairs, what is lost is the exact thing that you're talking about, the teaching and the passing down and the holding on to the morals and the principles and the just the core values of the family. That is what is so broken. So I mean it. When I say I want to see another book that just dives down into that, I am serious. Be motivated to continue to write in that vein. But meanwhile, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to come back to A Book Is Born with my guest, Edward Ray Hill, the author of One Mile at a Time, right back after these words.
In our lives every day, we are faced with difficult challenges that overwhelm us, that take a lot out of us emotionally, mentally, and physically. There are so many things that we can't control. Being held down by the struggles of life, we seek a transformation and a need to connect to the Lord, trusting in Him to complete us and to direct and lead us in the right path. From song lyricist and Christian author Alan T. Black comes his latest book, Just a Closer Walk, sharing the story of a journey that is sure to resonate with each reader. Just a Closer Walk is the third book for best-selling Christian author Alan T. Black. For more information, please visit alantblack.com. That's A-L-A-N-T-B-L-A-C-K.com.
Welcome back to A Book Is Born. Alan is no relation to me, Beverly Black, but he will be on our debut show tomorrow when we open up with Expressions of Blackness. So be sure to join us at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, same tribe family number, same tribe family station. Edward, back to you. Tell us about the fascinating book and the culmination of it. I want you to really dive in. Take your time.
The book is the story is the last great cross-continental road race ever run in America. But what I think you're going to find from the book and the way I looked at it, it's a metaphor for life. What I had learned from in previous years for how I handled life with the wisdom my grandmother had handed me allowed me to put in the situation. I didn't just run that race. I won it. And I still, 38 years later, hold the world's record in that race. No one has ever beaten it. So, I mean, I wanted it to understand the readers. There is a metaphor here because how I approach that race in the face of adversity is how we can approach life and when we're faced with adversity. I'm going to go back a little bit about life before the race, but I was in Ballin, Missouri, last place, hopelessly out of contention, midnight, a broken man on my knees praying, I can't go on. And I went back to the past, and it turned me into the future and performed a little bit of a miracle in getting there. I got to tell you that right now. But I will get into the story of the race. But I'm trying hoping the audience will understand that there is a spiritual context here. My grandmother's an extremely religious woman, but she was a big believer in you're being born with all the capabilities to handle life. Even the bad things that happen to you, you just have to pray to use it. And she would she would say, God helps those who help themselves, was a big thing. She says, you need to pray to God like it all depends on him. You need to work as hard as you can like it all depends on you. That's the kind of woman she was, and that's what she was teaching. And then she would say one other thing. There's two other things. She basically would say, there's two types of people in the world, Mick. That was my nickname she called me. There's people where life happens to them and people who happen to life. It's your choice the type of person you want to be. What she was trying to say is you can be a victim or you can be a participant in life. It's your choice. Okay? And then, the final thing she would instill upon me
Hold on one second before you go to the final thing. Hold that thought. Now, we are talking about someone that had to matriculate and learn how to survive in a whole other country that is preaching this. And life is not a cakewalk. It's already not a cakewalk. But then you traverse across, continents to find a better way of life, and you come with that type of perspective about life, you cannot help but make it. So that level of resolve and empowerment and spirituality and faith is phenomenal. And I love that you're dropping gems for our readers that they can hold and plant for life. It's more than about a book. You see, it's about life and our approach and response to life. So like I said, you expound as much as you want to, but her final saying was?
The last one is something I think we need to imprint upon our kids because life is going to throw them bad curveballs. They're going to get hit, and they can decide to be a victim or just take it on. That's the point. Life is going to happen to you, and if you want that, that's fine, but you should become a person that happens to life. You change life. You change for the better. I think that was it. The final thing is about miracles. The context of what I'm about to tell you is that we have a responsibility on this planet. There's two others. Actually, there's one after this I'm going to talk about that ties into this. But she would tell me, God does not make miracles happen. He works through people who do.
Mm.
And think about all the miracles in your life you've seen. Somebody did something. And they were inspired by God when they did it.
You know, see, you're preaching now. We can have church today because, you know, we really do have to. We are a result of someone coming to, two people coming together, others praying over us, fighting for us, opening the doors and the pathway, clearing the path for us. So we, our lives are a combination of all the very things, the strengths and the attributes that you're speaking of.
Yeah.
And coming down it, through, go ahead.
No, it, I guess I'm, I know we want to get into the race, but I want to set the tone of the background of the environment I grew up on, which really affects my attitude when I become broken, because we all run that in life, you know. We're human. If we think we're Superman and never get broken, you're crazy. It happens to all of us. It's how you, but remember, it's not how many times you fall. It's how many times you get back up. Okay? And that's really important. So that's the context of what I did, how I learned. My love of cars started when I was 12 years old. My grandmother, you know, she owned the Ford dealership that we talked about.
Right.
And she had three other dealerships, and it was most successful in the town she was in. But she always made me work. I had to go, at 12 years old, she got me a job at the dealership cutting grass. And that was what I had to do. And I'd be dragging it out and all that. And what happened on one June day in 1966, I showed up on a Saturday to get my lawnmower out and put the gas in and start cutting. And the salesman kind of, well, you're a young kid, they kind of take you under their wing. He says, hey, you know, Ed, why don't you come out in here? I want to, there's something on the radio, there's a race going on that I want to talk to you about that I think you'll like. And it was the 24 Hours of Le Mans. In 1966, where Carroll Shelby basically had put a team together to beat the Ferrari, who had never been beaten before, and he had basically, he was taking 1, 2, 3 in that race with Ford G40s, and the story mesmerized me because up to then, the only racing I knew about was drag racing, and that didn't seem appealing to me because there was a lot of power out of control. And then the oval racing, you know, around the track. And I thought, that's boring. Mm-hmm. But this was across – this is a big – it was a 24-hour race over, you know, 12 miles in a circuit. So you really had a road. You were on a road. And I said, wow, that sounds pretty good. I became intrigued. And the thing that impressed me was the lead driver in the Ford was a gentleman by the name of Ken Miles. Now, you may be, anybody who saw Ford versus Ferrari would understand who he is. But Ken was 35 miles ahead of everybody else. And Henry Ford was there, and he wanted to have, for marketing, he wanted his three Fords to cross the finish line in tandem for a picture, you know, a marketing shot. And they asked Ken to slow down. And I remember in the movie, this is what hit me really. I remember standing there, listening to the salesman, what's the matter? Something wrong with his car? I said, why is he slowing down? Well, in the movie, Ken's Miles since used the exact quote I used. And so it kind of, that's where the interest in the movie, I saw an identity there. But
wow.
What it did, it made an imprint on me. And it made an imprint on me because I found out the next day that he slowed down to help his teammates. So there's a lesson there. See what I'm saying? But that was the beginning of the fact that I was intrigued by, I tried to learn everything about Le Mans and what it was about and the idea of cross, you know, road racing as opposed to track racing or drag racing. I loved that. And of course, when I got to be 16, I got my driver's license. So I lived in this rural town of Gardenville, New York. I proceeded to drive as hard as I could through the back roads to learn how to do it. And I got my teeth cut on it. I've lost my brakes. I've gotten in all sorts of things with it, but I learned a lot about driving from that. And I did one of the mechanics pulled me aside and said, "Ed, you got a gift for driving." And that was something that stuck with me. So it became I loved it, but I also was listening to my grandmother that I had a responsibility to become, to make something of my life so that I can support a family and go on. So I never looked at racing as my career. I looked at, I went to high school, did the best I could, went to University of Notre Dame, ended up get an MBA to try a career. But there is one event in this period, and it's racing.
Okay, pin it right there. There's one event in this period. Don't lose your train of thought. I am so intrigued because your grandmother gave you that job. Now, you're 12 years old, and you get a cushy lawn mowing job at your grandparents' dealership, whereas you juxtapose that to her at 12 years old or your grandfather at 12 years old, and that's a whole different picture. And so I can't imagine the pride on your grandmother's face seeing her grandchild out there with the course of his life set way different from the life that how it began for her and her husband, you know, building it together and the four children and what have you. And so I just wanted to say that. That is simply an amazing story. And then, like you said, you know, the guys there taking you under their wing, and that was not happenstance or a coincidence, like people would say, but that was intended. And that was the intersection of the paradigm shift that would lead you to, you know, where you are today and the record that you hold. And to think that it really did start with your grandmother, like you are writing about, because of the trajectory and how it changed from mowing the lawns to being brought in the office and spoken to and all of that. So go ahead and I think it's just fascinating.
Well, I think I got something interesting for you. There's a step in between. So I'm 14, 15. I finally get working papers and I can really work at the dealership. So my grandmother, you know, sends me down a job, and she gave instructions to the general manager to give me the dirtiest job at the dealership for the summer. And my first job, you think about if you've ever been into kind of the garage repair bay for a dealership, like it's long, you know, lifts and cars, all that. In the middle, there's the iron grates that go down where it captures all the oil and gunk. My job was to go the entire length and shovel it out and get rid of it. And the reason why she did that was to teach me, you know, that you work to get ahead. But she wanted them to respect me because I was her grandson, and she was worried they were going to think I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. So she made me get the toughest jobs. That's how come the mechanics adopted me, because I did all the dirty work. You see what I'm saying? So that's an important lesson in life. You need to have respect from people, and you have to understand they have to believe that you're not going to treat them like you're better than they are. You know, it's important to do that.
And what I hear in all of that is a lesson in character building all around.
Yep.
Your grandmother was a very, very wise woman, and she knew exactly what she was doing. It's just really amazing because you can hear that she's driving this narrative. You know what I mean? This is not like she is directing this movie, okay? And you are the main character.
I want people to love her the way I did. I mean, she was an amazing human being, and she was wise, you know, wisdom that I. You know, I have advantages of having some of it, but I wish I had all of it. You know, but but that was the start of it all. And then, we're going to jump ahead to high school now, and this is a race situation. I started out joining, you know, trying to join sports at Bishop Allen High School. And I joined the cross country team and later the track team, and I was awful at it. But I kept on working at it. I almost quit one day, and I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't. And I ended up becoming captain of the track team. And I was in the season. I was a quarter miler, for people who know track, and I was undefeated and captain of the team. And through an accident of rules and that, we had the New York State regional all-Catholic meet coming up, and I didn't qualify because even though I was undefeated that season, I had run my races on cinder tracks as opposed to tarpaulin tracks, which are much faster. And the way they differentiated, you know, the 100 different runners, they went by time, and I didn't make the cut because of that. But the long and short story, if you get into it, you know, I was demoralized and felt, you know, 4 years of work. You know, one of the boys who won the quarter mile that day, I had already defeated in a race, and so, you know, I felt dejected. But the way this thing goes out, you get it in the book because it goes very much detail. I realized I was assigned to what's called a relay race, and this is where life comes in. That's the baton handing off. I was the anchor, the last person in it because of my speed, and we were getting destroyed. Let's put it that way. We were not, my team was mates, and they were being made fun of by other team members, you know, basically being a bunch of losers. And the story goes on how I responded. And read the book, you'll find out. Because that response is the same response I used to win the race with the four-ball rally.
Well, this is so exciting. We are live on A Book Is Born with my guest, Edward Rahil. This is a Michelle Berard LLC production. That's MICHELEBARARD.com. If you want to be a guest on A Book Is Born, get a hold of Michelle. She got a hookup for you. We're going to take a commercial break, and we'll be right back with Edward Rahil, author of 1 Mile at a Time on A Book Is Born via Tribe Family Channel.
Are you thinking about writing and or publishing a book but need help navigating the process? Path to Publishing is here to chauffeur you along your book writing and publishing journey. Visit us at www.pathtopublishing.com. That's two. T-O, the word, not to the numeral. www.pathtopublishing.com.
Welcome back live on Tribe Family Channels. A Book Is Born. I am Beverly Black. I am the CEO of Gumbo for the Soul Publications, and we are here to assist your writing journey. I call myself the doula or the midwife of manuscripts. We get you past those labor pains so that you can give birth to that baby. And we're going to talk to someone that has a book out, coming out, or it's already dropped. You will have to let me know. Author of 1 Mile at a Time, Edward Rahil. We are back live. Tell us about the book. We've got to know how our listeners are going to be able to attain it and take that further, deeper dive, because this is more than a race. It's character. It's morals. It's legacy and gems being handed to you, and it's the sweat of your brow, the work through your life, and the training therein. So it's really a life lesson. 1 Mile at a Time, Edward Rahil.
Thank you. And, you know, I appreciate this opportunity. I want to tell you thanks very much, Beverly. The book, 1 Mile at a Time, we're going to briefly explain how we got to that title. It happened in my senior year of high school in the regional all-Catholic meet. As anchor and feeling that I needed to help my teammates, you know, we had to show some kind of respect to get back. We were in last place. Everybody had passed me. They're on the way to the finish line. The 440-mile yard race, and I'm already 30 yards behind. And I took off with everything I had. And I was overwhelmed. I knew it was an impossible situation, but I was still going to open up. And I just started talking to myself. I said, one moment at a time, you know, one stride at a time, one runner at a time. And that's how I ran that race. Never about how far I had to go, that next step, okay? And I ended up, I ended up catching the leader coming off the fourth turn and ended up finishing second from last place, which was a major accomplishment. But that it was highly emotional. It was emotional for my teammates. You know, my coach was just ecstatic by it. And it was something I was very proud of because I went beyond and above what I could do. It was one of those extended miracle moments. And but that was something that imprinted me at the age of, I think I just had turned 18. It imprinted in my mind how to approach adversity when you go at it. You don't give up. You see what I'm saying? And I think
exactly
that,
what you're saying.
Yeah.
I love it.
Well, little did I know that the memory of that race was come to bear in 1984, the last great cross-continental road race. So that's
now,
there
well,
is a
pin,
link there.
Pin that right there for a second. Pin that right there because what you were telling yourself during this race, I mean, I could see that on a T-shirt if you ever think about it. Because herein, you are coaching yourself through this moment. Now, you think about the critical moments in a person's life.
Yeah.
Where they can't get through the next 15 seconds is critical. I'm a child sibling suicide survivor. My brother committed suicide.
Oh my!
I know what split seconds, you know, could mean. It's life and death. And here you are running this race, and you're not giving up because you're coaching yourself through. You're your own therapist in this moment. You are breathing, you are talking, you are empowering yourself, you're moving yourself, and you're getting past that space, and you're taking it a moment, you know, a runner, a mile, until you get down that road. And getting down that road is really what life is all about. It's not about quitting as soon as the race starts getting tough. And I love this message that you're conveying. But go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. By the way, my condolences for your family experiences. Those are very difficult.
Thank you. We deal with life, you know. So thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. The book, I'm going to move it along because I know we're running. I want to get a little bit into the race. You know, the book then chronicles my experiences at the University of Notre Dame, which changed my life. It's a unique university, but one of the few that basically still teaches Western civilization. I mean, the concept of right and wrong. There is a right. There is a wrong. There is a moral code that you live by. There is a history you got to learn. Of the good and the bad, you know, so you need to know the bad too, because you don't want it ever happen again. And that hit me spiritually quite. I went out for the Notre Dame football team. I made the team as a freshman, got injured, ripped Achilles tendon. I was in over my head. I was a track star. I was not a football player. And so I'm just so grateful that I got hurt because I could. It was an honorable way to leave. I was getting my bell rang every other play. And so, It was. I'm being honest with you, okay? I mean, there's something just because
rang.
You won. You don't win at everything. You got to pick the things that you can do it in. But I graduated, and it chronicles going through my first years after Notre Dame working at a company called Carborundum in Niagara Falls, New York. And being a young man, when in the division I was working on was about to be shut down because of a lawsuit, and how I got involved in the lawsuit for my boss, and how I basically came up with the solution. My grandmother always said to me, and this has been true in my life, I discovered it, I have a way of looking at the world differently. In other words, I look at a problem differently than other people do. And that comes to bear three or four times in my career where nobody else could figure out how to do it, but I could. And so that happened at Carbon, saved 200 jobs. I was shocked, and that was not my intention. And this is where the embarrassment, it wasn't my intention to save the workers. It was my intention to solve the problem. And then this is where I learned my actions impact other people. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I was trying to do the best job possible and to make the difference, but what I was doing isn't making a difference for 200 families. I didn't think about that at the time. And that's something, a lesson we have to learn. Like, we do, our actions make a difference in other people's lives. You may not know it. It happens. And I have another event later in Mexico that was dramatic, where we'll get to that in a moment. But we go through and I'll just give you a marriage, a brief one, to a woman who I have tremendous love and respect for. She had cystic fibrosis, mm-hmm. and that came to an end. And you can read the story to figure it out, but it was an amicable end from her perspective. I basically wanted to know that I did the right thing. By marrying her, I put her in a situation to get out of rural Buffalo, New York, into Chicago. And she only had 2 years to live in Buffalo. And in Chicago, they figured out how to give her an extra 20. You see what I'm saying?
Wow.
So there's a,
wow.
But that's another example about how we make, by doing something, you make a difference in other people's lives. And you don't always think
mm-hmm.
about it that way. You see what I'm
mm-hmm.
saying? And then mm-hmm. The love of my life, Nancy, comes into play. And I run the four ball rally twice. The first one was with a car that I had built. And I asked Nancy and I already had talked about naming our kids. And I asked her to run with me. And I said, I just want to run this race to learn how to do it. It'll be a great story to tell our grandchildren. And she bought into it. And so the story chronicles that part of it. And that the relationship, it goes into a lot of detail.
Mm-hmm.
It's a love story. It is.
Wow.
Pretty heavy.
Wow.
One. And the relationship, I mean, it came, let's put it this way. Nancy had passed away. And I got, after 40
rest
years, I called her sister. We were on the phone for an hour and a half. It was like old lost friends. She was telling me stories
wow.
about me back then. So it was that kind of relationship. It was really
mm-hmm.
a very a special one. And it goes
yeah.
on. And then that really, what had happened is that we came back from the first race. It was a tough race. We were tired of being around each other. Have you ever been tired around the guy you're with? And, because we had lived in the freaking car for 10 days. You know what I'm saying? And I needed to, we were just pissed at each other the way that would happen. And I needed some time to start. There's some complex twists as to why the relationship broke up. It had a lot to do with Nancy, which from a medical condition, the need to get pregnant faster than I could offer. There was a lot of stuff like
okay.
that. I don't want to get into it without the book. But Nancy was,
okay.
did what she could do and what she needed to do. I
okay.
had the tragedy is, and rather than me getting a handle on it after the race, within 3 days, I was drafted by Atlantic Richfield Corporate in Los Angeles.
Wow.
I got a call in the CEO's office, and they said, well, I worked for ARCO, and they said, we're putting on a special assignment in Mexico. You're going to join the Citibank task force working for the State Department, and you're to work on trying to find a way to save Latin America from bankruptcy. And they
wow.
literally gave me 3 days. They gave me medical kits, antibiotics, the whole nine yards, and then flew me down there. And I was only allowed to come back once every 2 weeks. And
wow,
that put in action me not being around to basically try to understand why she needed to have a child sooner, because she had endometriosis, and the doctors
mm-hmm.
were basically saying her that she needed surgery within the next year to 18 months. So what I'm trying to – that was back in the 80s. You know, they're much more advanced today, but that was – and so that, I'm just giving you enough of flavor of why the dynamics of, that we broke up. And it devastated me. I mean, it was
–
as a woman, we had – our first son, she wanted to name our first son Benjamin Franklin. But seriously, we got into that kind of discussion.
Wow.
You see what I'm saying? That loss of that really –
I'm so sorry
really,
to hear that,
Well – it carried me. It really broke me a lot. And my decision to run the second race with a gentleman who I loved as a friend, Tim Montgomery, I was going to do it, but my heart, my mind was in it, but not my heart. I felt like I, what's life worth living, that type of thing.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And we went, Tim and I did, I'm not a quitter, so I did the best I could. You know, we spent a lot of time practicing road racing, going to Indianapolis, spending a lot of time on the road getting to it. And what I talk about in the book that's important to understand, your mind is a beautiful thing. Your mind changes how fast it reacts based on the experience. You start out driving a car at 60 miles an hour, 70, you think it's fast. And then you take her up to 100, 120, and you get overwhelmed. But if you do it enough, 120 feels like 70 after a while. The world opens up for you, and everything becomes clear, and everything slows down, even though you're doing 120, 130. I'm not kidding you. And anybody who's racing cars will tell you the same thing. The mind is it really has the capabilities to adjust to its environment, and speed is one of them. But you have to give it exposure to it. Okay, you see what I'm saying?
I do, you know. Wow.
So I wanted people to understand that speed can be extremely dangerous, but your ability to handle it, and race car drivers know this because they deal with it all the time, is conditioning. Like a boxer's got a condition, a track star, a football player's got a condition. A race car driver has to be in good physical shape, but they have to condition their mind, just like a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important, and you'll learn a little bit about that. I go heavily into the techniques of driving fast and how you do it. So anybody who reads this is going to learn a lot about how to handle a car and how to make it work for you at higher speeds. Because that's what I did. I worked hard on it. The long and short of it is that we made a decision to go for it, Tim and I. To win,
well, pin it
and we got
right
the breakup.
Tim and I.
Yep.
Pin it right there, and we're going to come right back after this last commercial break on A Book Is Born via Tribe Family Channel. I'm Beverly Black. This is a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand created, owned, and operated by yours truly. Today's production is by Michelle Barard, MichelleBarard.com. I'm going to keep telling you that because that's how you're going to get on this show. So be sure to visit Michelle Barard, that's with one L, .com. We'll be right back after this commercial.
Revive Funding Solutions is your one-stop shop for all of your funding needs. We provide capital for business, real estate, or personal situations. Our programs include term loans, lines of credit, hard money loans, private money loans, business loans, residential or commercial mortgages, refinancing, and more. Serving clients all over the U.S. and abroad for over 6 years. Reach out to us today to see how we can help you. Minimum funding from $30,000 plus. Send funding requests to bit.ly/funding-link-form or email finance@revive-movement.com. Call or give us a text at 410-575-4356 for details.
Welcome back live to A Book Is Born. I'm Beverly Black. This is Tribe Family Channel. I'm having the wonderful, wonderful discussion with guest Edward Ray Hill, author of 1 Mile at a Time. And I'm telling you, this is beyond a book. This is beyond a story about a race coast to coast. This is character building, life lessons, and gems for your soul.
Thank you.
So we're going to get back to Edward
continue on, you and Tim, in the last minutes of our show.
Quickly, I was in a bad space at that time. I mean, I would, and so I was not motivated to run this race. I had run into a situation where I learned that Nancy, the woman I love, had basically predicted that I didn't have what it took to win it, and that I it was a kind of a tough situation emotionally. Tim and I spent a year putting the car together. We got a break because while we were working on it, some engineers at the Milford Proving Grounds or General Motors found out what we were doing, and they had been pissed about these races because it had been foreign cars that were winning it all the time. The year before I won it, the head test car driver for Porsche won the thing. And so, I mean, these were heavy hitters that I was up against. And they basically contacted us and said, we're not allowed to participate in any kind of road racing, but you buy the car, we'll fix it. And they re-engineered that car. It looked like a standard Pontiac Trans Am, but that had an 85-gallon gas tank, had a 450-horsepower engine in it, and she was built for speed. And it was a miracle that we had that relationship. The tires were race tires. It was just amazing. The brakes were great. And the long and short of it, we went for it. Tim and I intended to win. Well, let me tell you, the first half of the race was a disaster. In New York State, I get arrested. You talk about when I was one of the six arrested. I not only got arrested, because I got arrested every time in this race, because Tim was lucky. And they couldn't get me on speeding because we had radar jamming equipment. But they searched the car illegally and found a radio scanner. Used to call the Bearcat scanner and said that was illegal and put handcuffs on me and drove me back to the county seat where a judge happened to be there, and I went on trial. And the fun thing about this was I'm standing there with my handcuffs, standing in front of the judge, and she's saying, no, I got a wedding to go to this afternoon, so let's get on. The cop makes his pitch. No, this is a true story. The cop makes his pitch. Yeah, well, he's listening to our radio things, and it's a receiver that he can listen to everything we're talking about, so he knows what we're doing. And then she looked at me and said, what do you got to say for yourself? And I swear to God, this way I said, Your Honor, under the 1934 Congressional Act passed by Congress, every American citizen is allowed to receive all radio broadcasts. They're not allowed to broadcast themselves. As the officer just said, it was a receiver, and I'm an American citizen. And she looked at me, stared at me. She looked back at the cop, stared at him. She looked back at me and got a grin ear to ear and said, he's right. Get the freaking caps off him and take him back to his car. I swear to God that happened. God bless her. And I still had lost a couple hours. And then in Ohio, Ohio again, I'm driving. And we're heading down I-70, and all of a sudden, a radar detector goes off, and Tim hits the jamming equipment. He's the navigator, so his job is to jam the radar. And all of a sudden, I see this gray car with the lights going on. He's coming across the media. I said, oh, Jim, we didn't get him. I ended up saying, look, the rule is not to run the cops. You pull over. I violated that rule in California, which we'll get real quick. What we did, I pulled over. I had my license registration with both of my hands outside the window so he could see what's going on. He walked on me. Hi, Mr. Rahal. How you doing? I said, what? So I said, well, we got an all-points bullet. I know who you were before I pulled you over. He said, I want you to step back to my car. And he did. And I stepped back, and he proceeded to tell me that, I've been doing this for 15 years, and my radar detector came up at 56 miles an hour. I said, but if you're moving all, you're doing 120. He says, so I was trying to figure out how to arrest you legally, and I noticed you pulled off the road without using your turn signal. I swear to God.
He smiled at me
and said, so this is a little bit like Monopoly. You're going to lose a turn. And he showed me the all-points bulletin out across the entire United States for me and everybody else. And he sat there with the nicest guy, talked to me. He says, yeah, this is my day off. When I heard you guys are running, I volunteered to come in. And the long and short of it, he arrested four other drivers. He got the super. We had a tradition of a super trooper award. The cop that we would recognize the cop that arrested most. He showed up to the awards banquet with his wife to get the trophy.
Well, he had it in for you before he met you.
I swear to God, and that was it.
He got out there.
But the point is that there was a relationship back then where cops are just people like you, you know?
Right.
Right now they have a job where they have quotas. They got to do their job. They're not going to have that kind of fun. The end of the day, then we break down. We're in last place by hours. I'm sitting there broken, thinking about Nancy saying I wasn't going to be able to make it. Mm. Tim had quit. He wanted to go home, took a nap.
Uh-oh.
And I just had a come-to-Jesus moment where I really was begging for what to do because I could not drive anymore. Mm. I was broken. Mm. I didn't want anything to do with the car. And there's a series of moments in there where I reflect on things. And the one thing that I remember from my grandmother, the most devastating emotion you will ever experience is fear. It will break your will and turn you against everything you believe in. When that moment comes, force yourself to recall your past and who you are. From your past, you can find the courage to re-engage the struggle. It'll show you the way. I know it's emotional, but you know, you're bringing back a period of my life, which I know. And it was true. I got back in that car, and I flew. Averaged from St. Louis to San Diego with stops, breakdowns, traffic, and everything, 104 miles an hour. St. Louis to Adrian, Texas, 128 miles an hour. And it was, I don't know how I did it. I mean, it was just, but I remember telling myself, thinking back on that track race about how I handled that, I just went, you know, one moment at a time, one car at a time, 1 mile at a time. I kept on saying that. And every car I passed, I treated as a little victory. My objective was to pass that car. It wasn't to get to San Diego. And that was the character that got me through it. And we had a thrilling, we did run a police roadblock in California, involved a helicopter chase, which the story gets into pretty well. Tim and I decided for the first time not to pull over. We decided to run, and we ended up winning the thing. And so that's where we were.
You know what? I can see this movie in my head about this whole book and your life. I am visualizing the movie. I know we're talking about the book, but I swear I'm in the movie right now.
What? The reason why I wanted to do the backup is if there's a movie, I want it to be more than just this isn't the Cannonball Run movie, but it's gone a long time ago. This is a story. I wanted to entertain people but it's a true story. And that's I wanted to attach the human nature to the race. And that's what I did.
And I love just how character building and life and the vicissitudes of overcoming the vicissitudes of life and overcoming them is threaded throughout. And it came right back around to your grandmother. We started off with your grandmother, and we're coming back to your grandmother in what you just said and how emotional this is for you. And this is really a book of adventure, of life, of love, and of how bad do you want it and what you are willing to do and say
yes.
to yourself to get it. And I am fascinated by your story. I'm fascinated to have had this interview with you. Time goes by fast when you're having fun, and this hour has already come to a close. But I just want to congratulate you on your book. Now, tell our readers where they can connect so that they can get their copy of 1 Mile at a Time. Shout out any promotions.
Okay, we're going to go June of this year. The reason why is I'm going to be doing a lot of social marketing and book tours type of things to set up for it, because I would like this to be a movie, and I want to, in order to have it happen, it has to be successful. So I appreciate any help to do that. But June 15th, obviously there'll be Amazon, but we're not trying to make Amazon. We might have to go through all the bookstores and outlets. I'm going to try to do an audiobook too. I'm working with Michelle on that. And I want to tell the story. I want to tell the story of how you can live your life and how the world can be a better place because you were here. That's the story I want to tell them. And I want to pass it on. I'm in the last third of my life. I want to pass it on to the next generation. That's what the purpose of the book is. It was for my kids, but now it's even for more.
Fascinating, fascinating. Well, thank you so very much for the opportunity, for the bird's eye view into the story and the anticipatory drop in June. And I will definitely filter any and all information that would be of any assistance to you to Michelle Barrard. I want to thank Michelle for this opportunity and this fascinating interview with you. I want to remind our listeners, Edward Rahill, author of 1 Mile at a Time, will be making his debut in June of 2024. I want you to visit MICHELEBARARD.com. That's Michelle with one L, Barrard.com. If you're interested in getting 1 Mile at a Time, if you're interested in connecting with Mr. Rahill, and of course, pre-ordering his book, you can also visit EdwardRahill.com, EdwardRahill.com. And then, of course, if you'd like to recap this show, that's going to be following our studio at blogtalkradio.com/gumbo for the soul. I'm Beverly Black. I'm the CEO of Tribe Family Channel and Gumbo for the Soul Publications. So you can visit gumbofortheSoulInternational.com, and you can also hit up TribeFamilyChannel@gmail.com to schedule your own book profile or spotlight and book drop party. If you're interested in
coming to
the book.
Thank you for having me, Beverly.
It's my honor. And you have a blessed rest of your weekend. Thank you so much for being on A Book is Born.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's going to wrap it up for us. Visit GumboForTheSoulInternational.com to publish your own book today. Have a blessed day, and we are going to end with the song that we started with. That is by the Shy Lights, and we are broadcasting right out of Las Vegas, Nevada, from the Shy Lights Chateau. Yes. So this is Happy Birthday. This is a tribute to all of those that would dare to give birth to their book.
Happy birthday. Yeah. We want to dedicate this song to everyone who has a birthday today. And that means you and you and you and you. Because having a birthday is a special occasion. We hope you have a happy celebration and a many, many more to come.